Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And Professor Keisha Blaine, I'd like to start today with this question to you. Were you surprised by the violence at the Capitol last week?
I was not. Unfortunately, I think, given a number of developments over the last couple of months and years, quite frankly, and looking at it in a broader spectrum throughout the course of U.S. history, I think it was inevitable that we would have experienced certainly what we did at the Capitol last week.
Inevitable. Okay, so this is Keisha Blaine. She's a professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh and president of the African American Intellectual History Association. She's a co-editor of a forthcoming book called 400 Souls, co-edited with Ibram X. Kendi. And Professor Blaine, thank you so much for joining us today. I also want to turn that same question to Brittany Packnett Cunningham. Were you surprised by what happened at the Capitol last week?
I agree, Blaine. To be surprised is to have ignored hundreds of years of history that exemplify just how much white supremacy exists, how pervasive it is, and how violent it becomes, especially when it is desperate. And not only is Donald Trump desperate, but white supremacy is very desperate right now.
Well, Brittany Packnett Cunningham is a writer and activist and host of Undistracted, the podcast, and also co-founder of Campaign Zero, a project to end police violence. So thank you so much for being willing to spend the hour with us as well, Brittany. So I'd like to hear from both of you, and Professor Blaine, I'll just start with you. What were the signs, as you saw them, of white supremacy and racism demonstrated at the attack on the Capitol last week?
Well, I think immediately of the symbol of the Confederate flag, and we certainly understand the history of the Confederate flag. We understand that it represents the Confederate States of America, which was a failed experiment, but nonetheless a powerful one in its attempt to really dismantle the vision of democracy that I think so many of us are fighting for and committed to. Every time you see the Confederate flag, you know that white supremacy is in the midst. It's not surprising, of course, that the Confederate flag also made an appearance in the 2017 Unite the Right rally. And so I think that symbol, that person walking through the Capitol building, carrying that flag, was perhaps the most powerful symbol to demonstrate to the world that this was very much about white supremacy.
That photograph that you're describing, it will be burned into to American history for a time to come. I will never stop thinking about that, to be perfectly honest. And Brittany Packnett Cunningham, did you see, you know, one man carrying a flag is something to note, but were there other more pervasive signs of white supremacy in the riot?
I mean, there were plenty, right? We saw incredibly anti-Semitic sweatshirts and T-shirts. We saw the noose on the gallows. We saw a wooden cross erected on one side of the Capitol. But I think what's really important to recognize is that violence itself is an often used symbol of white supremacy. That so often when we see it exacted in its most extreme examples, Dylann Roof, the Unite the Right rally, and yes, the Capitol insurrection, the violence itself, perpetuated mostly by straight white men who claim Christianity, but I would debate that, they are using a level of rage to express the fact that they believe they have dominion over, as I've said before, everyone and everything, including the institutions and the buildings and the people central to the function of democracy. So the violence itself is a symbol of white supremacy. And it's important that we don't separate the two, because that is what helps us see this trend and this pattern over generations and hundreds of years. It is the consistent reoccurrence of violence. It is not just individualized. It is systemic. It is institutional. And it is very, very real.
Professor Blaine, your thoughts on that?
I agree. And I think it's really troubling to be in this particular moment and hear so many people say that they were surprised by what took place at the Capitol building, because, you know, as Brittany points out, this is really part of a very, very long history. We've seen this play out time and time again. And of course, we saw President Trump for the last couple of years inciting white supremacists, spouting white supremacist rhetoric. And it was only a matter of time that we would find ourselves at a place where we would see this violence on display in this attempt to really undermine American democracy.
So the reason why I know my questions might actually sound obtuse, right? Because for anybody paying attention, you know, seeing the Confederate flag, seeing that Camp Auschwitz shirt. I mean, those are just two of the many examples we could point to. The signs are pretty clear. But the reason why I just kind of wanted to go through that carefully is because, as both of you know, when the issue of white supremacy is brought up, there's an automatic resistance among some people, right? Because their response is, well, we just have concerns with how the government functions. It's not racist. So let me just play a couple of clips that I think demonstrate that. I'd love to hear your response to these clips. So first of all, here is Tucker Carlson on Fox News, and he was talking about a letter written in a private school that had characterized what happened at the Capitol as racist. And Carlson pushed back against that, and here's what he said.
Whatever you thought about what happened yesterday, what was racist about it? Well, nothing, of course. There was nothing racist about it. The Berkshire School is lying. So is everyone else on the left. Why are they doing that? Simple. They know that if they keep saying it, history will record it as true.
Okay, so that's Tucker Carlson on Fox News. I get it. It's Fox. But millions of people still watch Fox, and they nod their heads in affirmation when Carlson says things like that. And so Brittany, I just wonder, like, how do you respond to that? How would you tell the people who agree with Carlson that, no, actually what happened was grounded in racism?
Well, I think that the only appropriate question is why these folks are so invested in maintaining that myth. Mm-hmm. And the answer, of course, is obvious. The culture of white supremacy is beneficial to people like Tucker Carlson and the folks who would like to believe his rhetoric. It has made him wealthy. It has given him a platform. It has given him legitimacy that he did not earn. It has allowed him a level of fame and notoriety that he believes is attached to his merit, but that I would woefully disagree with. So he's not invested in denouncing the very things that have elevated him. And it behooves him to act as though he is not attached to the racism that was on display during the insurrection. He is one of the people that helped fuel this fire. And he knows that people will continue to come after his advertisers, after his audience, after the very platform that he holds so dear to spew that hate. We will come after that because we know the danger that it holds. That's not something he's interested in losing. So he wants to disassociate himself from any of not just the activity that we saw, but any of the undercurrents that brought it to pass.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is that there's also, in addition to that, there was, you know, it's not it's not just media personalities like Tucker Carlson on Fox News. There's pushback to even bringing up the issue of racism and white supremacy, even including in the House itself amongst elected officials, right? I mean, we saw yesterday during the House impeachment debate. I'll just play this moment here where Representative Cori Bush, a Democrat from Missouri, she denounced President Trump using very specific language and got a very pointed response. So let's listen to that moment.
If we fail to remove a white supremacist president who incited a white supremacist insurrection, it's communities like Missouri's 1st District that suffer the most. The 117th Congress must understand that we have a mandate to legislate in defense of black lives. The first step in that process is to root out white supremacy, starting with impeaching the white supremacist in chief. Thank you, and I yield back.
And from New York wishes to reserve. The gentleman from Ohio seeks recognition.
Right. So it's a little hard to hear in the tape there, but following Representative Bush's comments, there was some booing that came from other members of the House. Professor Blaine, how did you think through that moment?
Well, you know, I always tell my students, if you want to understand the root of a problem, you have to pay attention to the rhetoric, certainly, but you also have to pay attention to the praxis, which is to say that you need to pay attention to what people do in as much as you pay attention to what they say. And I think about this through the lens of the Civil War. You would be hard pressed to find a Confederate soldier who would say, oh, this is a war in order to maintain slavery. In fact, the rhetoric was, this is a war to maintain states' rights. But of course, states' rights to do what? To maintain slavery. And so we can go back and forth, we can go around in circles, and we could say, oh, the Civil War was not about slavery. It was actually about slaves' rights, right? I mean, states' rights. But ultimately, what you're doing is covering up the underlying reason. And I think this is true. It's hard to find people who are going to say, yes, I walked into the Capitol building screaming because I'm trying to uphold white supremacy. Have you ever heard a racist say, yes, I'm a racist? People are not going to accept their idea. You know, they're just not going to embrace these terms. But we know that they're white supremacists because we understand how all of these are connected.
Well, Professor Blaine and Brittany Packnett Cunningham, just stand by for a minute, if you could, because we do have to take our first break here. We'll talk a lot more about how to understand the attack on the Capitol through the lens of racism in America. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are exploring how racism and white supremacy changes our understanding of what happened, or should inform our understanding of what happened in the attack on the Capitol building of the United States of America last week. I'm joined today by Brittany Packnett Cunningham. She's a writer and activist and host of Undistracted, the podcast, also co-founder of Campaign Zero, a project to end police violence. Keisha Blaine joins us as well. She's professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh and president of the African American Intellectual History Association. And, you know, Professor Blaine, before the break, you had talked about how very few people, even at the riot, would say, I am there because I'm a racist. I just wanted to follow up a little bit more and hear from you more about that, because it brought to mind, again, what happened in the House debate yesterday. There were several really interesting moments of people pushing back against the idea that race had anything to do with the attack on the Capitol. So, for example, here's Republican Glenn Grothman on the House floor yesterday explaining why he did not vote for impeachment and responding to Democrats' characterizations of what happened on January 6th.
What is offensive is what you are saying and inflammatory about the tens of thousands of peaceful protesters who were there last week, as well as the tens of millions of people they represent. You don't understand why they were here. They're scared to death we're going to go back to the days without Donald Trump, of hundreds of thousands of people crossing this border every month. They're scared to death nobody's going to keep our manufacturing here. They're scared to death that nobody else will fight the cancel culture as we head towards an era when some things can't be said. They're scared to death that a majority party got here by teaming up with Black Lives Matter, a bunch of founded by Marxists,
the gentleman's time
and
has
the dislike
expired.
Of family.
The gentleman's time's expired.
So, Professor Blaine, there's a lot that we could pick apart in that clip there. But I wanted to just start with the fact that Grothman used the term inflammatory, that it was inflammatory even to mention the possibility of racism being a part of, or perhaps even a driving factor in the events of January 6th. Your thoughts on that?
It's a common practice. I think everyone who writes about race and racism in particular would encounter the typical reader who would say, by pointing out race, by talking about racism, you are the racist, right? It's the typical response. One of the questions that I would ask is, okay, if this is all about anxieties, whether they be economic or otherwise, then explain to me the presence of the Confederate flag, then explain to me the presence of the noose, then explain to me the violence, and explain, right, everything else that we saw on display. And of course, then we get back to the core of the problem, which is it makes for good rhetoric to say this has nothing to do with race, this has nothing to do with white supremacy. And maybe some people firmly believe that, but the actions tell us exactly what it is about, and we can't deny what we see before our very eyes.
Mm. And Brittany Packnett Cunningham, do you want to add to that?
Well, I think Professor Blaine makes some critical points, but let's look at what the chief complaint was that has caused a number of actions. It is the idea that this election was illegitimate mm-hmm. because Donald Trump was not the winner. We watched Donald J. Trump and his associates target cities and states where an overwhelming majority of Black voters and voters of color were the deciders in his loss. So the idea that if Black people, Indigenous people, Latinx people, LGBTQ people, young people, progressive people are the deciders of the election, that it must be illegitimate, that in and of itself is white supremacy. This, some of these things that the congressperson said in the recording that you just shared, he said that they're scared to death. Scared to death of what? Scared to death of people crossing borders that their ancestors, that white people's ancestors crossed in order to be here, because this is not a white country. This is a country that originally belonged to Indigenous people and that was built by enslaved Africans. He talked about a party that he says was partnered with Black Lives Matter. Well, what is the premise of the phrase and the movement Black Lives Matter? It is the fundamental idea that our humanity matters too. And if that scares you, that is a tenet of white supremacy. That fear is based in white supremacy. That fear is not legitimate. It is not fair. It is certainly not humane. He literally told us exactly what this is about while claiming that it wasn't about white supremacy. So I agree with Professor Blaine's actions. And if you even listen to what is being said, this is very clearly about white supremacy, about systemic racism, and about maintaining a social order, a caste system, and a racial order that benefits white people to the detriment of all else.
Mm. Well, Professor Blaine and Brittany Packnett Cunningham, just I'd like to invite another voice into this conversation, because you mentioned the religious symbolism that we also saw on January 6th as well. And so let me turn now to Jamar Tisby. president and co-founder of Witness, a Black Christian collective, and author of The Color of Compromise, The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism. Jamar Tisby, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna and esteemed guests.
So tell us first, what or how much religious symbolism did you see amongst the insurrectionists on January 6th?
It was everywhere. You had Jesus 2020 signs right alongside Trump 2020 signs. You had this massive cross that was mentioned earlier. You had T-shirts that said God, guns, and country kind of language. You had people praying about their cause in overthrowing Congress and the election. The religious symbolism simply could not be missed.
And what were you thinking, or how did you think through when you were seeing all that?
Oh, it was very disturbing. As a person of faith, as a Christian myself, it was very disturbing and yet not surprising. So I thought about it on several levels, which is that this is a sign of white supremacist Christian nationalism. There's this conflation with the success of the United States, namely economically and politically, with the success and growth of the church itself. There's this idea that the United States is the promised land and God's chosen nation that will succeed above all others. And as the nation goes, so goes the church, which is, of course, a perversion of Christianity as defined in scripture and by thousands of years of practicing Christians.
Mm. So tell me more about that, because given what you're describing, and I mean even the shallowest read of American history shows that there has been that religion or a form of religious belief has been one of the animating features of sustaining racism in this country. I mean, your whole book about The Truth About America's Church's Complicity in Racism. So is this just sort of the most recent overt sign of that we've seen?
Yes, in many ways, this is a contextually specific manifestation of a pattern that has been true for centuries of U.S. history. And what it has to do with primarily this idea of Christian nationalism is a vision of the world, and namely of the United States as white, as Protestant Christian, as belonging to native-born, United States-born, politically and socially conservative people. And they sort of baptize all of that with their interpretation of the Bible, and it becomes this holy cause. But this is certainly in continuity with a lot of what we see throughout U.S. history. In 1915, for instance, was the second iteration of the Ku Klux Klan, and on Thanksgiving Day, a former white Methodist circuit rider goes up with a group of his white friends to the top of Stone Mountain, Georgia, which is covered with Confederate iconography and a desecration of indigenous people's land. And they have this religious symbolism there, a cross, which they burn. Of course, that becomes a symbol of terrorism. But they also build an altar, and on it they place a Bible and an American flag. So that was one manifestation in the Jim Crow era. I think we're seeing another one in the 21st century.
Hmm. Do you think that what happened on the 6th of January, that attack on the Capitol, when it spilled over from a rally into an insurrection, a violent insurrection, that served? Have you been hearing from white Christians that you know that did it serve as a kind of wake up call?
I think the dividing lines have been widening over the past several years, particularly during the Trump presidency. Was it a wake-up call? I think what it did was catalyze a small number of white Christians to be more vocal than they have been. I'm not sure that it had a large impact on people moving from one set of convictions, that being pro-Trump, to another set of convictions of being anti-Trump or never Trump. I'm not sure that that was the big impact of the insurrection, but it put in stark relief and very chilling terms the threat of overthrowing democracy itself, how urgent this issue is and how much it needs to be addressed.
Well, Keisha Blaine and Brittany Packnett Cunningham, I appreciate your patience in listening along with us to Jamar Tisby. I'd ask you to just listen a little bit more, because we reached out to David Cassidy, who's lead pastor at Christ Community Church in Franklin, Tennessee. And most of his congregants and the community that they live in are white. And here's how Pastor Cassidy felt. This is what he told us as he watched the violence unfold on January 6th.
As a Christian pastor, grieved beyond words at the presence of people with Bibles walking around or Jesus banners or Christian music playing. And as an American citizen, horrified that the people who are elected representatives in this really sacred space, so to speak, of the Capitol, this place where we view as a symbol of the strength of our democratic principles, being trampled on by people in the name of patriotism. So it's grievous for Christians, and it should grieve us, and it's grievous for American citizens of all kinds. It's just horrifying.
Horrifying, but Cassidy also says he was not surprised to see Christian symbols alongside the political symbols.
I think this predates the administration by some time. Theologically, pastors have really kind of sent a message over the last several years, and Christian leaders of all kinds, seminary presidents and others, that there are acceptable and unacceptable candidates based on these particular matters. And then here's your list of issues. Well, there's a fundamental assumption behind that that's deeply arrogant, and that is that Christian leaders are supposed to be endorsing parties and candidates. The task of the church is not to make America great again. The task of the church is to make Jesus known to everyone everywhere.
And when he says pastors, Cassidy clarifies that he specifically means other white pastors.
My African-American friends who are evangelicals have not been in any danger of this kind of Christian nationalism, which we've seen recently, which equates the cause of Christ with the cause of a political candidate or party.
And Pastor Cassidy says he believes Christians need to disentangle themselves from politics. He told us he sees step one as religious leaders needing to get out of the political endorsement game, and step two, take a hard look at history.
The first home I lived in here in Williamson County, the home across the street, was Nathan Bedford Forrest's home, who was, of course, a principal founder of the Ku Klux Klan. So there's a deep-rooted racism in many places, and that has to be recognized. It has to be confessed as sin. It has to be repudiated and repented of. And we as leaders need to model the kind of unity of spirit and soul and purpose and real friendship that that kind of repentance would look like.
That's David Cassidy, lead pastor at Christ Community Church in Franklin, Tennessee. Jamar Tisby, what were you thinking as you heard Cassidy talk through that?
It reminded me of the conversation you were having earlier in the show about people who saw the insurrection, claimed it had nothing to do with white supremacy or racism, and how easily that sort of denial, that blindness, translates into the pulpit and rhetoric from pastors and church leaders. I don't know anything about Reverend Cassidy per se, but I do know that it's very easy for Christian leaders to sort of say the right thing, to sound the right notes about race and racism, but then in their everyday practice of teaching people, of leading their congregations, they implicitly endorse the causes and the aims of the insurrection. So they'll imply that there's only truly one Christian way to vote, and that's obviously not for a Democrat. They will intimate that America is a Christian nation founded on Christian principles, and that it should be governed as such and completely ignore the religious pluralism and the ideological pluralism of this nation. So I would look more closely at the day-to-day practice of what they are expressly or implicitly endorsing as far as a political and a social vision.
Mm. But of course, Christianity has been used also to advance progressive political goals as well. I mean, some of the greatest civil rights leaders come from the Christian tradition as well. So is it as clear-cut as Christianity should not be involved in politics at all?
You're absolutely right to say that Christianity has been a force for progressive social change. And we saw that we really saw this sort of battle between these two visions of Christianity in the Georgia Senate runoff between Loeffler and Warnock. Mm-hmm. And I think what you bring up is an important point, because in the national discourse, we have to understand that there are other Christian traditions and other ways of practicing Christianity than what we see from Trump's evangelical advisory board or the Robert Jeffress of the world or whomever you might name. And yes, religion in general and Christianity in particular, when we talk about the United States, can be a force for progressive change, especially along racial and political lines. And that should not be ignored or subsumed in the sort of energy-sucking white Protestant Christian nationalist evangelical discourse that's happening.
Well, Brittany Packnett Cunningham and Keisha Blaine, I know you probably have a lot that you want to add to what Jamar Tisby has been telling us. So just hang on here for a minute. When we come back from the break, I want to get your responses. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to bring back some of the voters that we talked to across the summer and into the fall in our 12-part series of voter roundtables to see what they thought about what happened or what they think about what happened on the 6th of January and if it's changed their view of how they voted and what they want for this country moving forward. So we want to hear from you as well. You know, how are you thinking about the vote that you cast in November or before November if you voted early? And if you could speak to your fellow voters, whoever they are, across whatever divide you see between you and them, what would you tell them? How would you have that conversation? Call us and leave a message at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we are talking about looking through the insurrection at the Capitol, looking at the insurrection at the Capitol through the lens of racism and white supremacy in this country. I'm joined today by Jamar Tisby, president and co-founder of Witness, a Black Christian collective. Brittany Packnett Cunningham joins us as well. She's host of Undistracted, the podcast, and co-founder of Campaign Zero, a project to end police violence. And Keisha Blaine joins us. She's professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh and president of the African American Intellectual History Association. And Brittany, let me turn to you first, because both you and Professor Blaine listened along with me as we were talking with Jamar about Christian nationalism in this country. And I was wondering, you know, what your thoughts were on that.
Well, I have plenty as the daughter of not one, but two ministers. But I was raised in a Black liberation theology. That tradition is very clear that justice and peace and freedom is not just reserved for heaven, but that it should be made manifest on earth. And that too is part of our work as people of faith. And so I would push on this point that the pastor and the clip made that there should not be a social gospel, if you will, but the social gospel should actually be aligned with Christ's own teachings. I'm very clear as a Black woman in America that politics is interested in me, whether or not I am interested in it. It is Black radical feminists who helped us understand that the personal is political. And the same is true whether I'm sitting in a pew or I'm sitting in my home or I'm out in the street. Like the pastor, I too was grieved as a person of faith, but I've also been grieved by the church as an institution in their practices of patriarchy and heterosexism that have extended so much pain to so many people. And I believe that we are in a moment of reckoning as an entire country, but also as the church, to figure out whether or not we are going to or not. I mean, Psalms literally says that whoever oppresses the poor insults their maker. Not only are we grieved as people of faith, but God is grieved by these practices. I also think it's really important to stop letting white supremacists assume the shield of Christianity. So the so-called Christian right has been wrangling that title for themselves and trying to steal a label that does not belong to them. I fully believe in the work that a lot of us are doing to reclaim Jesus for the bronze-skinned, woolly-haired justice warrior refugee killed by the state and resurrected by the ultimate loving figure that he actually is. Ruby Sales, who is a longtime freedom fighter and was one of the original members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and I were in conversation a few days ago, and she rightfully it's not Christianity. These are folks who have supplanted God with a worship of money, with a worship of patriarchy, with a worship of white supremacy. She calls it the theology of the empire, and that these are folks who've actually created God in their own image, not the other way around. So these are folks who haven't read the instruction manual, and I think it's high time that we stop allowing people to supplant God, whatever your religious beliefs are, with a white supremacist, patriarchal, heterosexist ideology and theology that is the opposite of the peace and justice that Jesus actually stood for.
Professor Blaine?
Well, the only thing that I would add, similar to Brittany, is certainly, you know, push back against this notion that religion and politics should not mix. I think certainly if you look at history, we understand that religion broadly and Christianity in particular has always played a key role in shaping American politics. And I think about this through the lens of slavery. One of the things that I always teach about is the fact that at the very same moment in our nation's history that several religious leaders were challenging slavery in the United States, there were also religious leaders, sometimes even in the same faith, upholding slavery and defending slavery. And in both cases, they would use verses from the Bible, right? Mm-hmm. So some would use verses from the Bible to say that slavery is actually God-ordained and it's not so terrible. And others would use a range of other verses to suggest that slavery was, an act of sin and that it flew in the face of God's plan and for people. So ultimately, I think religious leaders in general need to make a choice. They can, such as, you know, the Quakers in U.S. history, who played a key role in the abolitionist movement. You can take a stand in this moment to challenge white supremacy, or you could take the opposite approach, which is to uphold white supremacy. And you uphold white supremacy when you do nothing, when you say nothing, and when you tell your congregants to vote for Trump or, you know, vote for a Republican simply because of all of these other factors, and steer people away from really, I think, offering a critical analysis as it pertains to race and class and sexuality. You know, as Brittany points out, I think religious leaders need to step up in this moment and take a stand.
Right. You know, Jamar Tisby, this makes me wonder that ideally the United States, as we collectively try to struggle towards certain quote-unquote American ideals, that perhaps, I mean, wouldn't it be a better situation if religion weren't even involved in that struggle? And here's why I say, like, if the United States, and that I get it, there's a big if, but if the United States is a country that believes in basic equality or seeks to move in the direction of basic equality, that isn't a value that should require religious justification, and it's also a value that should withstand religious justifications that try to tear it down. I mean, I personally, I'm just wondering if we should just remove religion entirely from what this nation should try to achieve.
I think it depends on. Go ahead.
Oh no! Go ahead.
I think it depends on what we mean by, you know, religion being involved in politics. So there's a sense in which what we are trying to do legislatively, whether as voters or actual elected officials, is derived from our most deeply held convictions. And so for many people, those are religiously held convictions, whatever that religion might not be. For many people, they are not directly tied to a faith tradition. And in that sense, if we are simply trying to sort of express our deep moral convictions in legislation to sort of structure our interactions with one another in this country, I don't even think it's possible to really remove that type of morality from politics. I also think that we need to understand that it is very possible for religious people to be political without imposing their own religion on other people. And so we don't necessarily have to advocate a theocracy where the government is structured along our particular religious beliefs, but we can move toward these ideals and these aspirations of liberty, one person, one vote, democracy, and those things that can be inclusive of different faith traditions without this, what I really think is not genuinely feasible or possible to completely divorce your political motivations and convictions from your perhaps religious convictions as well.
And Brittany, go ahead and jump in.
Well, I think Jamar is making such important points. There is a responsibility of the state to uphold everyone's humanity, irrespective of their belief system, if they choose to have a faith or not. And so I fundamentally believe in the separation of the two. And at the same time, I also recognize that if, as a human being, I choose to sit in a pew or a mosque or a synagogue, if I choose to kneel at an altar or meditate toward a god, that the people who are the religious leaders of the sect that I am a part of have a responsibility to ensure that I am a citizen who is someone who actually stands up for all citizens, not someone who preaches a theology of exclusion, but of inclusion, of equity, and of liberation. So I think that there are two separate questions about the responsibility of the state and the responsibility of those who preach to the people in the pews. And I think it's important that we hold both to account, even as they are separate.
Well, I would like to spend the last 5 minutes of the show here, really hearing from all three of you about, so what happens now as we, you know, think about the racism and white supremacy that we saw on display on January 6th. So we spoke with Sergeant Heather Taylor. She is a former homicide detective with the St. Louis Metro Police Department. She's actually someone that we spent an hour with this summer, hearing her story as an African-American homicide detective in St. Louis about racism within the force that she served with. We touched base with her again, And in terms of moving forward now, here's what she told us.
Our country needs an overhaul when it comes to recognizing all levels of white supremacy, whether it's in the media, whether it comes in healthcare. We know it exists in all these different entities. And if we don't make eliminating white supremacy and racism a top priority in our country, it's how our kids are being raised. It's how newsrooms are being run. It's how politics are being run. It's so many different entities that must admit that there is a problem.
So, Professor Blaine, I know this is a big question, but I'll just ask it anyway. What should the next steps be if, as Sergeant Taylor is saying there, everywhere she looks, she sees evidence of white supremacy? How do we push back against that?
Well, I think, as Sergeant Taylor points out, it's important for us to, at first, from the very beginning, acknowledge that there's a problem. And I find it deeply frustrating that we keep finding ourselves at the same place over and over again as a nation. And I've seen this play out just in recent years, you know, at the moment of the Charleston shooting, the tragic killing of 9 Black people in the Emmanuel AME Church. Several people said, okay, this is our moment of reckoning, right? This is the moment that we're going to acknowledge that white supremacy is a problem in our nation, and we're going to work to dismantle it. And then before long, people sort of look the other way, and before long, they're distracted, and then something else happens, and then all of a sudden, we're having this conversation, and we're finally talking about white supremacy. But what hasn't happened, I think, is a sustained conversation that moves us actually from talking to action. And I think what I'm certainly hoping for is moving forward that we begin to put in place actual policies that do, in fact, work to dismantle white supremacy in all aspects of society. And it's going to take a lot of work. Clearly, we didn't come here overnight. I mean, all of this didn't happen overnight. It took hundreds of years. And so it's going to take a very long time to dismantle, but we have to continue fighting, and we cannot be complacent, and we cannot look away, and we cannot be distracted.
Looks like we're having a bit of trouble on the line there with you, Professor Blaine. So Brittany and Jamar, I'll give you both. We just got a minute left for each of you. Answer that same question. What would you like to see happen next? And Brittany, go ahead.
Well, I believe that especially given this insurrection, there needs to be a massive level of accountability. Obviously, the House has begun that with holding Donald Trump accountable, and I'm so proud of my hometown Congresswoman Cori Bush for how she stood up to that. But there is removal that needs to happen, including those members of Congress who incited this very same activity. But there also needs to be accountability and reckoning in journalism, in political donations and campaigning, in all of the places socially and politically that created this moment and that have led to another resurrection of white domestic terrorism in this country.
And Jamar?
Accountability here is key. It begins with truth and how we are crafting the narrative about this insurrection right now is going to be very important. And then how we hold people accountable. I'm reminded of the happenings immediately after the Civil War when Confederate leaders and soldiers, treasonous people who separated from the Union, were treated with great leniency, given amnesty and pardons. And that opened the door for literal decades of white supremacist extremism. So if we don't deal with the perpetrators now through not electing them, getting passing impeachment, all of those things just mentioned, then we are at the beginning, not the end, of insurrections like this.
Well, Jamar Tisby is president and co-founder of Witness, a Black Christian collective, and also author of several books, including The Color of Compromise, The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism. Thank you so much for joining us today. And Brittany Packnett Cunningham, host of Undistracted, the podcast, writer and activist and co-founder of Campaign Zero, a project to end police violence. Brittany, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Keisha Blaine, professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, president of the African American Intellectual History Association. And her forthcoming book is 400 Souls, co-edited with Ibram X. Kendi. Professor Blaine, I think we have you back just in time for me to say thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.